Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Today, we're continuing in our series on climate change. Later in the program, we're going to be talking to Native American activist, economist, and writer Winona LaDuke. I'm very happy now to welcome environmentalist and author Bill McKibben. He's been writing about global warming and alternative energy for over two decades, and he's the co-founder of 350.org. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, what a pleasure to join you.
Thank you. So we are living through a period of rapid climate change, which is following a long period of climate stability. And because it's happening so fast, I think it's hard for people to grasp that contrast. Explain to us what kind of fluctuations in climate we've seen during the last 10,000 years of human civilization and what we're seeing now.
The last 10,000 years, we've lived in a sweet spot. Scientists call it the Holocene. The temperature has stayed the same because the amount of carbon in the atmosphere stayed the same, 275 parts per million, give or take. So 200 years ago, we begin to burn coal and gas and oil. We call this the Industrial Revolution. It starts getting us rich. It also starts putting lots of carbon into the atmosphere. And that, as that number begins to go up, some prescient scientists begin to worry because they know that the molecular structure of CO2 traps heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. We really start to worry about this in the late 1980s. When we have computer models big enough to show that we're approaching a danger point, but we don't know exactly where it is. We really get the first numerical calculation of that danger only a couple of years ago when Jim Hansen at NASA, our foremost climatologist, and his team publish a paper saying that the most carbon we can safely have in the atmosphere is 350 parts per million. Anything greater is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. That's bad news because we're already past 350. We're at 390 parts per million now and growing about 2 parts per million per year. That's why we're now beginning to see truly epic destabilization of one physical system after another around our Earth.
I think there are many listeners who understand that climate change is not a thing of the future, but a thing of the present. But for many of us, we don't, you know, we don't go to the poles and we don't see the ice melting. We don't perceive the oceans rising and warming and acidifying. We're not at the Amazon rainforest and seeing it drying. All of these things are interrelated. All of them have huge consequences. We could spend the rest of the day discussing each one in detail. But here in the Southwest, I mean, here in Santa Fe, it's been raining, it's been snowing. And so even here, it's hard for us sometimes to believe that we are in a drought. What's happening? How has the Southwest already changed? And what are we likely to see if we keep on with business as usual?
Well, you know, the same thing that's happening all over the world is happening in the Southwest. The temperature goes up. Now, that puts more energy into the system, and it causes all kinds of things to happen. In a dry period, you get more evaporation, hence more possibility of drought. And it looks like across, in the sort of greater scheme of things, across both the Southwest and Australia, we're seeing that drought. The dry subtropics are kind of expanding north and south. When there is a wet period, or in wet parts of the world, we see unprecedented downpour. Sometimes we see all these things happening in very quick succession. Pakistan, 6 weeks ago, recorded the warmest temperature ever in the Asian continent, 129 degrees. 6 weeks later, they had the largest rainstorm ever recorded in a thousand years for which they have any kind of records. And as a result, there are now 12 million people out of their homes trying to figure out how they're going to survive. We look at Russia this week with the warmest temperatures ever recorded there and hideous fires burning all over the place. We look at the American West and we see longer-term things, the slow diminution of the snowpack, and maybe more strikingly, the rapid disintegration of the pine forest across Canada and now down the spine of the Rockies into the U.S., the pine bark beetle, customarily held in check by cold winter temperatures, no longer encounters those cold winter temperatures, and so it's on a rampage.
You've been studying and looking at climate change since the 1980s, and the Earth we're living on, and I think this is a fascinating concept that you bring out, is not the same Earth that we grew up on. If the very best scenario happened and we reached 350 parts per million, do you think we would reach a new climate equilibrium?
Well, Marichal, we're clearly past the point where we're going to stop global warming. That's not going to happen. We've already raised the planet's temperature 1 degree, and there's another degree in the pipeline. And that's what's causing these chaotic fluctuations and perturbations in so many of our systems. We don't know what kind of world we'll settle at if we bring carbon emissions under control. But it's a pretty safe bet that it'll be more like the one that we know, somewhat more manageable, the lower that we hold those temperature increases to. So I've told you that we've already got a degree and another degree in the pipeline. But the climatologists around the world have made it very clear that unless we're able to get off fossil fuel with great rapidity, we're looking at 5 or 6 degrees in the course of this century. And there's no reason at all to think that civilization can cope with 5 or 6 degrees.
When you say in the pipeline, I think something that's also not intuitive is that the climate change we experience now is happening because of the actions that we did years ago, not what we did yesterday.
That's right. This is all cumulative, but the stuff we did yesterday is just as important as what we did years ago. I mean, it's pushing us further and further and further. The real question is what we'll do tomorrow, if we have any chance of slowing this so that at some point that curve begins to level off, because right now it's looking awfully, awfully grim.
Where do you think we are right now in the United States in terms of public understanding of the issue of climate change and in terms of our ability to make political change that would avert the most disastrous consequences?
Well, to the first question, public understanding, the polling indicates, depending how you ask the question, that someplace between two-thirds and three-quarters of Americans understand that there's a problem and that humans are causing it. But for the most part, they don't take it particularly seriously, and clearly our political class takes it not seriously at all, hence the perfect, unblemished, two-decade-long bipartisan record of accomplishing nothing on Capitol Hill. The opportunity for changing that, I think, lies in building a movement big enough to force attention to these issues. It doesn't have to come from 50 or 60 or 70% of people. If it comes from 3 or 4 or 5% of people who are really fired up and ready to make this the center of their political lives, then we have a chance of shaking that inertia.
We're talking to environmentalist and author Bill McKibben. When we talk about life on Earth becoming, I mean, it's not just human life, but life on Earth being really endangered by a few degrees of climate change, give us a handful of examples, both for our species and for other species, including things that are already happening right now.
Well, I mean, if you're worried about other species, we're seeing this summer rapid die-off of coral reefs around the world from warmer water temperatures and from acidification of water. In fact, there was a study released in Nature 2 weeks ago indicating that something like 50% of the plankton in the world's oceans is missing due to warming water over the last 50 years. That's a pretty sobering scale of change. And it helps us understand that really there's no very good line between other species and our own, ultimately dependent as we are on the smooth functioning of things like marine ecosystems. For human beings, the one credible estimate put forward by researchers is that 300,000 people a year are already dying from the effects of climate change. But most of the modeling of what will happen in the future makes it clear that that's a tiny beginning on a very tragic story, that we can look forward to hundreds of millions of refugees on the move as parts of the planet become increasingly less habitable. We already see things like, well, just in the last few days, the price of grain shooting, spiking upward as the Russians, besieged by drought, cut off exports of wheat from one of the three or four great grain-growing regions of the world.
As you write, and I find this absolutely fascinating, a barrel of oil, one barrel of oil, represents thousands of hours of human labor, and it is because oil is such an incredibly concentrated energy source that the modern civilization that we live in has become possible. Let's say we go toward clean energy and renewable energy and all of that overnight, which of course we're not going to do, but let's say we could. Or the realistic scenario of making a conversion as quickly as possible. Do you see that the level of energy intensity in our global civilization is maintainable, or do you see us going back to a kind of an older way of life?
I don't know about older way of life. I mean, I think that there are features of the current way of life we'll want to try to maintain and others that we'll want to change. For instance, agriculture has become incredibly energy intensive. We've substituted all human labor for oil in this part of the world. That's why less than 1% of Americans are farmers. My guess is that number's not sustainable. I doubt that we'll return to having 50% of Americans on the farm, but I think it's a very good sign that the local food movement is already beginning to nudge those numbers a little bit. Last year, the USDA reported that for the first time in a century and a half, the number of farms in America was on the rise instead of declining, and it's because we're beginning to build these stronger local food networks. We have a lot more work to do along these lines, but at least it's a beginning.
What do you see as most hindering political change in the United States?
Well, certainly some inertia. You know, this is the world that we're used to, and it's hard to change. More than that, I think, strong vested interest on the part of people in the coal, oil, and gas industries, which, after all, are the most profitable industries that human beings have ever created. I mean, Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money. In our political system, that buys you a lot of influence, especially if all you're trying to do is delay action. And that's been the strategy all along of the energy companies. So there's no mistaking what a hard fight it is. Now we've seen that we're no match for it at the moment. We couldn't even get a vote in the Senate on very, very watered down and weak compromise legislation. Couldn't even get a vote on it. We're going to have to build a bigger movement if we have any hope of coming at these guys.
It's become sort of a cliche that if the United States leads, then the rest of the world will follow. Let's say the United States finally gets itself together, and New Mexico is attempting at this point to be a leader in that way, putting on carbon caps, cultivating clean energy technologies, and so on. Do you think the rest of the world will follow, including, for example, India and China, which are in very intense development phases?
I don't know. Only one way to find out. But at the moment, there's no danger of us leading. In fact, today, the Chinese announced that in order to meet their goals for decreasing energy use, they were shutting down 2,000 factories across China, some of their most antiquated and energy-intensive factories. The Chinese are doing far more at the moment than we are on these questions. I just came back from China, where they were, I talked with the guy who runs the biggest company making solar hot water heaters in the country. About a quarter of the Chinese, 250 million people, when they take a shower, it's with hot water from solar panels on their roof. New Mexico, which has sun galore, I bet that number is under 1%. It gives you some indication of just how badly we've done.
And China is also building coal plants at a very rapid rate.
Absolutely. They're nowhere near us in per capita terms for energy use, but they're growing rapidly. And so the question is, can we figure out a way, working as a planet, to allow them and everybody else some other way to develop that doesn't follow our path? At the moment, we're not helping.
We're talking to environmentalist and author Bill McKibben. These questions ultimately boil down to moral questions, and we have a kind of scenario, and we saw this in Copenhagen, which turned out to be a terrible disaster, but basically third world people saying to the first world, your actions are drying up the mountains from which we get our water and are drying up the lands from which we get our food. These are gigantic moral questions. Do we have the right to do that? What is our responsibility when we do that? We've made a mess in somebody else's yard. Is it our responsibility to clean it up? Do you feel that this is being framed as a moral issue out in the world and in the media?
Not in this country as much as it should be, but it's certainly one of the things we try to do at 350.org, which is the first really global climate movement that we've got going. We operate in 181 countries, and one of the points that we're always trying to make is we've got to figure out how every place to tackle this problem. And as I say, what leadership there is increasingly is coming from small, poor countries. The Maldives Islands, an entirely Muslim nation in the Indian Ocean, announced last month that they were going to be entirely carbon neutral by 2020. That's pretty good stuff. So far, we can't even get the president to put solar panels on the White House. We're not making much progress.
And as you write, there are countries that are actually working on evacuating their entire population.
Well, yes, if you're low to the ocean, it's not going to be an easy century. If you're in a grain-growing region, it's not going to be an easy century. If you're in a forested part of the world, or if you depend on snowpack for your water, as you know, some of those acequias in New Mexico flow out of the ultimately out of the mountains, it's not going to be an easy century. It's not going to be an easy century anywhere. Our job is to try to keep it from becoming an impossible one.
So why are you testifying in New Mexico on behalf of the petition to cap carbon dioxide emissions?
Well, because it's very important every place to get to work on this. New Mexico can't solve the problem by itself, but it can lend a hand in helping lead the way, and that would be entirely appropriate. You know, New Mexico is a place of enormous scenic beauty and enormous heritage and history, and those things should both be brought to bear to help lead this fight.
You write that if even the most, I think some guys at MIT made this model where they plugged in every scenario, every positive scenario, every government pledge that was made in Copenhagen, and if all of those positive scenarios had been adopted, we still wouldn't be getting anywhere near the 350 mark, but rather we'd be above 700 by the end of this century.
That's right. It's ample demonstration that the ideas, that the pledges that our governments have come up with so far are not anywhere near rising to the task. They're not working hard enough. They're not thinking hard enough about how we can make change. It's going to be very, very difficult. We have to get off coal in the next 20 years. Doing that will be as hard as anything humans have ever done. The only thing harder will be dealing with the alternative, which is a planet gone to rack and ruin.
You've been doing this for so long, and a kind of glazed over either non-understanding or cynicism on the part of the fossil fuel companies and the politicians, I mean, to many of us is very disheartening. What gives you hope that we can achieve this 350?
If you want hope, go to 350.org and just look at the photos from last October's big global day of action, the first real effort around the world to draw attention to this problem. We managed to coordinate 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries, what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. Note when you look at the pictures that very few of the people look like our stereotype of environmentalists, rich, white Westerners. Most of them are poor, black, brown, Asian, young, because that's what most of the world is. And they're just as concerned about the future as anybody else, and that gives me great hope to see huge demonstrations that are all women in burqas that are at the hot top of the Himalayas, underwater on the Great Barrier Reef, every place in between. That's very, to me, very exciting and powerful.
Do you see any positive change in how the mainstream media are covering this issue?
Not yet. I don't think the mainstream media in this country have done itself proud on this issue over the years. And I hope that that will change. One test will be when you read stories about things like these epic fires underway in Russia, whether or not they're able to make it clear that this is comes because we've changed the environment, that it's not just a one-off fluke, that it's precisely the kind of thing that scientists have been telling us to expect.
Bill McKibben is an environmentalist and author who's been writing about global warming and alternative energy for many years. He's the co-founder of 350.org, on the web at 350.org. You can also go to billmckibben.com. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
I'm very happy now to welcome Winona LaDuke. She's a Native American activist, environmentalist, economist, and writer. She's the executive director of the organizations Honor the Earth and White Earth Land Recovery Project. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you are one of the people who's going to be testifying in front of the Environmental Improvement Board here in New Mexico in favor of a carbon cap. And one of the things that I found fascinating is that Ojibwe prophecies speak of a time when people will have a choice between two paths, the scorched earth path and the green path. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they refer to this as the time of the seventh fire, the time that we're in now. And these prophets came to our people a long time ago, and they, of course, talked about things ahead. And they said that, that we would be these people who were cognizant. They call us the Ashki Anishinaabeg, and said that we would have awakened from a lot of trauma and a lot of a loss of consciousness, and these new people would have a choice between two paths ahead of us, and one would be well-worn but scorched, and the other would not be well-worn, it would be green, and it would be our choice upon which path to embark. And that was instructions for us as Anishinaabeg people, but that is also really instructions, and I think that it's really very emblematic or symbolic of where the United States is at. You're at this point where we've combusted ourselves to the edge of oblivion. We're looking at a 2-degree temperature rise. We've got, you know, a fossil fuel dependent economy without a plan B at all, pretty much, just, you know, to keep drilling for it where we shouldn't be drilling for it, or combusting it when we shouldn't be combusting it. And we have the technology, we have the intellectual capital, or Europe does if we haven't capitalized it, and we have the financial resources plus the long-term financial mandate to make this transition. And so, we feel that it's very symbolic. And so the hearing that's being held this next week down in New Mexico that's been ongoing that I'm coming down for is very significant to all of us.
Is that what led you to begin studying climate change and its effect on Native people?
Well, an intersection between our traditional teachings and prophecies. I mean, I am a member of our Madewan Society. I do a lot of, our work in around this spiritual realm is significant. You know, it's one of our main spiritual teachings up here. But more than that, perhaps, I have spent my whole life working on a lot of these issues. You know, I live on this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful reservation full of lakes and wild rice and maple trees and... What you notice is, first I noticed the coal plants and that I have mercury advisories out for most of the fishing lakes on my reservation. And that in itself is a problem, that we find that we are people who can't eat the fish because of there's mercury from coal-fired power plants that are upwind from us. So that's a huge problem for our community because we're low income in terms of money, our cash economy, but we are wealthy in terms of what the Creator gave us for fish and for deer and for food here. And you know, it is a good life we were given. So, we look at it from that terms, and then we notice that, you know, some things are changing here, not as rapidly as in other places. But I believe that not just a corporation, but one entity doesn't have a right for the purpose of profits and lack of visionary thinking or just laziness to transform ecosystems from lush ecosystems to ecosystems that are hit by torrential rains, windstorms, drought, chaotic hailstorms. And that's what we're beginning to see up here.
Tell us some of the ways in which climate change disproportionately affects Native people and low-income communities. I mean, the issue of environmental justice is incredibly strong, not only in things like coal-fired power plants and so on, but climate change.
Well, to begin with, I mean, climate change is leveling. You know, everybody is affected by it. If you're rich or you're poor, it does not matter. But the thing is that the indigenous people, by and large, are living in these places where we have either been driven or we retained because they were remote. So, for instance, the Pacific. You know, a good portion of the people who live on islands in the Pacific region are indigenous peoples, and their islands are going under. So if you look at Mother Jones a few issues ago, Tuvalu, looking for a new country because their island is going underwater. Kivalina, Shishmaref, a couple of Alaskan Native villages up in Alaska are falling into the ocean because of dramatic climate change. Greenland just lost this huge glacier. Majority population of Greenland is Inuit people. And so you have people who are in these remote or these Pacific or, you know, these Pacific-based areas that are heavily impacted by climate change already. Then you add to that the people that are looking at drought on a worldwide scale or torrential storms in quite often war-torn countries, you know, who find that not only are they afflicted by the trauma of intergenerational warfare, but now on top of that they have increasing loss of habitat, loss of ability to produce their food. And so on a worldwide scale, the people who are more disproportionately affected are poor people, indigenous people, people war-torn areas. And so those people who are living in Albuquerque or Phoenix in some climate-controlled environment, it's such a strange concept to me, climate-controlled environment. There's a perception that climate change isn't really a problem. You're going from your air-conditioned house to your air-conditioned car. But in the meantime, the amount of energy required to keep that at a comfortable level is increasing, and the impact of the energy that is used to keep some kind of control over your personal bubble is increasing. And that is what's causing the problems to begin to spiral in the broader world. So the privilege of living in a bubble may be yours for now, but the reality is that over the long term, we're projecting, I mean, first of all, that they called them the death maps. They came out on USA Today. And Albuquerque area, New Mexico, Great Plains area, hardest hit areas are people who live in trailers or in the Great Plains because of severe weather conditions, you know, more at risk from these issues of climate change. And then people who are, you know, issues like diseases that travel are more likely to travel in a time of global climate transformation or global climate change. And then we will begin looking at the impact upon states and countries. They're projecting that by the year 2020, that 20% of world GDP will be spent on climate change-related impact already. That's on a worldwide scale, and that's coming out of British studies. State of New Mexico, $3.2 billion annually minimum costs. $6.3 billion by 2040, and if we make it and haven't baked ourselves into oblivion by 2080, $18.4 billion annually. That's what we're looking at with the impact on our economy. And so, you know, it's kind of like fix it now, do the right thing now, or just try to scramble later and see what we can live with.
We're talking to Native American activist, environmentalist, and economist Winona LaDuke. The thing you said a moment ago about people feeling that it's their right to live in a personal bubble, that really bespeaks a whole mentality that one house is not connected to the next house, one family to the next family, one town to the next town, rather than the more accurate reality that we are all connected via our ecosystem. So there's a real kind of thought transformation that needs to happen.
No, that's right. And I feel like that we don't want to be those people that perceive that we can live in a bubble because, you know what, that's just not healthy.
Right.
Not only is it lonely in the bubble, you know, if you spend all your time in a bubble colliding with other bubbles and interacting in your climate-controlled world, but, you know, in addition to that, it's you become somebody who no longer is a part of the creation and the natural world that the Creator gave us. You know, and so we have a beautiful, beautiful opportunity here to do the right thing. In New Mexico, and everywhere. We have the beauty and the opportunity to keep our Mother Earth from combusting, to create a shot where to ensure that there's an opportunity for our children and our grandchildren to grow food and provide for our own communities in a way that, you know, has some kind of food security. We have an opportunity to reduce the health impact of climate change, whether it is airborne contaminants or the misery of dying from heat wave or desertification. We have the opportunity to save our economy from squandering and hemorrhaging its wealth to disasters which could have been prevented by some foresight and a denial of access to endless greed. That's who we are. We're the people that have the opportunity to do the right thing. And, you know, in New Mexico, that is the question that is being asked. Does anyone want to look out? Does anybody want to do the right thing? Does anyone want to transform an inefficient coal-based energy economy to a solar and wind economy? Because the long-term economic benefits of relocalizing energy are immense. And the reality is first of all, if you pay for a solar economy or a wind economy, you can project the price of fuel into the future. In other words, you're not subject to the vagaries of a fossil fuel market, whether it is coal, natural gas, or oil. You are in a situation where you know that the sun will be shining and that you can generate power from that. And that has immense stability for an economy, whether it is a small village, whether it is the city of Santa Fe, or it is a statewide projection. In addition to that, you're not going to incur the costs of the disasters related to climate change, which has a huge economic benefit. I feel like you do this because it is the right. We do this because it is the right thing. It is how you think clearly. But in addition to that, we do this because it makes economic sense to make good decisions.
What kinds of changes are you seeing in Minnesota as a result of climate change?
Well, most of the changes we've seen in Minnesota really have to do with more torrential storms, winds. I mean, the town of Wardena made the news a couple of months ago because it got flattened in a tornado. I mean, bad way to make the news, but that's what I'm looking at,
right,
is a lot of wind. You know, and I just rebuilt a house after a fire, and I rebuilt it for climate change. I'm praying hard that things are okay because you cannot really predict. But, you know, I considered where I put my solar panels. I considered what kind of roof system I use because the winds are getting more significant where I live. And, you know, I'm doing the best I can, but I had an opportunity to make a house that was a little bit stronger than the house I had before, and so I did that. But not most people don't have that opportunity. There's a lot of people on my reservation and in northern Minnesota that are living in trailers, and they're flipping the first big wind that comes through. So, you know, that's what we're seeing. Droughts, more hailstorms, earlier frosts. And so, you know, what we are doing is trying to put up more wind turbines. I'm fighting to get online here on the power lines. And we're also growing more local food, and we're growing heritage varieties that are not genetically engineered, because a lot of these really old varieties are pre-industrial agriculture, pre-irrigation, and they're more frost resistant. So I refer to them as, you know, having a better shot in the time of climate change.
What are some of the ways in which Native American traditions can show a different path than the one that we're taking?
Well, you know, I don't have all those answers. You know, but what I would say is that if you're asking for more of a spiritual analysis of this, there is a different worldview. There are many complex worldviews. I was trained as an economist. I went to Harvard, and I spent time at MIT in graduate school. I am fully aware and painfully aware of the economic model that permeates American culture. And I'm also painfully aware of the impact of that model on Indian communities or on other communities who have been mined, irradiated, groundwater contamination throughout New Mexico or elsewhere in the world. The diseconomies of this analysis are not considered and run roughshod over long-term stability in any means. A durable you know, if that's what we would call it, a durable approach to an economy, is a holistic view that says, first, let us look here and figure out how to live peacefully. So, for instance, our word, Ndinaway Muganatuk, we are all related, which means that our relatives may have fins or wings or roots or hooves. And it is our responsibility to be careful, mindful, and respectful of all of those relatives and not view them only as natural resources which are managed, cultivated, harvested, and destroyed. That's a very different paradigm of valuing life, you know, which I always, not to be, I always hear about the pro-life forces. I'm like, well, what about all these relatives? Are we not pro their life also?
Right.
Then you look at, you could bring further, like, who has the right to transform that life form? You know, in our teachings, we don't have that right. We have the right to be respectful. And if you're respectful, you'll have a good life. Minobamadaziwan, a good life. If you are respectful, kind, thoughtful, you know, and you are doing the right thing. Then, the next step from that is in a lot of our traditions, there is far more value associated with giving than in accumulating. And that is one of the problems we are facing. In this American society and American paradigm, we are faced with the idea that accumulation and aggrandizement of wealth, you know, accumulating it, wealth and power, is associated with those two things. In a native spiritual tradition, the stature is associated with the giving of yourself, the giving of all you can from, in giveaways. You see that traditionally at a lot of our cultural practices. That's what your stature is associated with, not with taking, but with giving. And then, you know, you look at the long term. You're interviewing me from New Mexico. Those guys been down there for 8,000, 10,000 years. They seem to have a pretty good hang on how to live down there. You know, it might be a good thing to note for a city like Albuquerque, which does not seem to have a plan. I mean, not to cast aspersions, but just to say, look, try to figure out how to live within your means, because that would be a better plan over the long term.
We're talking to Native American activist, environmentalist, and economist Winona LaDuke. One of the things that what you're saying, I think, points up very strongly is that when you get overly into accumulation, you also create so much waste, and that waste is part of the climate change problem.
Yeah, I mean, you've got waste heat to start with in climate change. You know, so, and you've got the fact that it's estimated that at least a half to two-thirds of the power that from the point of origin to the point of use from centralized power production is squandered and wasted. And that, you know, it's like fishing. You know, you could use an analogy of bycatch and factory trawlers, where two-thirds of the fish is thrown back into the ocean dead as a doorknob before it ends up at Long John Silver's or at Red Lobster. And that bycatch, all of that is incredibly destructive to the ecosystem and is destructive to life forms. So why would we want to continue in the state of New Mexico or elsewhere, continue to capitalize an inefficient energy economy when we could, one, be more efficient across the board, two, build housing that doesn't require such a massive amount of air conditioning, three, consider our whole workforce strategy on when people work and when they don't work and, you know, how this is and how much transporting they do. Four, you look at efficiency in everything from our appliances to our household choices. Five, create local power systems where every house in the Southwest is powered by solar. You know, this guy, David Melton, not to pitch him, but, you know, over there, Sacred Power, they're doing solar for the military, and they're over there in Albuquerque. These guys have the capacity to do solar power across the board. There's, you know, native and non-native contractors that could save the state of New Mexico billions of dollars and save them the cost of putting up new bad power plants. So it's endless, the situation that we're in and the opportunity to get out of it. But it's a shame that we live in a country where, you know, you look at some place like Spain, and I believe about half the power in Spain comes from wind energy. I'm not sure But most there's many countries in Europe that are just far advanced, and we, you know, in New Mexico has the potential to produce its entire energy economy largely from solar and wind, and there is no reason to not be the leader in that, because that's where economic stability comes from.
A lot of politicians talk about the importance of doing something about climate change, and they often use the term, Bill McKibben points this out in some of his writings, for the sake of their grandchildren. Can you talk about the gap between what politicians say and what they do in terms of climate change?
Well, one of the things that I notice is that in the time of climate change, what I've noticed is that a lot of politicians are interested in what's going to happen on their watch. So these guys will be on in 4 years. And so they are thinking, well, it's not going to happen on my watch. I mean, I heard this. I actually heard this talking to a tribal government. That's not going to happen on my watch, so why am I worried about it? That approach is the challenge. In indigenous traditions, for instance, the Iroquois Confederacy, the appointment of chiefs was a process, it was called condolence, condoling of chiefs. That process was undertaken by the clan mothers. The leaders of their community, the clan mothers, would appoint or condole a chief, and they had the power to remove a chief, which is interesting because the founding fathers followed a democracy system of the Iroquois Confederacy because they had no experience with democracy, but the Six Nations are the longest-standing democracy on the continent and one of the longest-standing in the world. Anyway, they call it condoling for a reason, because you take, as a leader, the responsibility for your people. And so the greatness of the weight is why they are condoled into that responsibility. And that, I think, is something that, you know, it is a great weight that politicians have, but I think that far too often the significance spiritually of doing the right thing intergenerationally at the moment that they are in is lost. So I encourage leaders, political leaders in the state of New Mexico and elsewhere, to recognize this moment we are in. Now is the time to address climate change. New Mexico is one of the most egregious states in the country. New Mexico, Arizona, Wyoming, Montana. There you go. That's some pretty big combustors out there. And those states have the opportunity to provide some leadership and follow and even set a higher bar than California, and create a new energy economy that will catapult the state into a leadership on climate change, and more than that, transform the economy from one that is fossil fuel dependent and full of the vagaries of a fossil fuel economy into a long-term self-reliant economy.
Tell us about some of the clean energy and diverse energy initiatives that you've seen in Native communities.
Okay, well, you know, when we began talking, I was trying to get the keys to the door to the wind turbine.
Right.
We put up a wind turbine here on the White Earth Reservation that's a 75-kilowatt lowland wind turbine. And that turbine is to power this facility that I am in. And I am still battling the power company to get online and to hook the whole system up. But what I would tell you is that this is a model of both the potential and the challenges faced by rural communities in generating community-controlled power. So we are working on this here on our reservation. The Rosebud Tribe in South Dakota has a 750-kilowatt wind turbine up. The Shakopee Mittewakanton Dakota has a 1.5-megawatt wind turbine that powers their reservation and is looking to expand to more wind turbines in the next couple of years. They also have a biodiesel facility, I think, using biodiesel from the waste oil from their tribal casino. They have a gray water system, an apiary. Is that where bees are kept?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's what it is, apiary.
Yeah.
And greenhouses. You know, just more innovation. And I'm telling you something of that scale because I know that there are tribal casinos in New Mexico, but I also know that there are facilities of that scale that have the potential to run entirely on solar or to be more efficient. Personally, my personal suggestion has always been that they should go back to kind of old school in gaming where you pull the crank to get your money. I'm not much of a gambler, but pull the crank to try to get your money after you put your quarter in. And if you could have the cranks power the building,
right,
you know, if you're following what I'm saying.
Right, right.
Then they probably would make a lot of money, and that whole process of energy production, I'm sure, would be awesome. You know, similar for every one time they have one of those darn gyms, and you go in there to the gym to work out, and they have all these electric machines. I'm like, why are they not powering the building off of the treadmill?
Exactly, and the stationary bicycles.
Yeah, yeah. There's, you know, a lot of opportunities. So let's just be more innovative. You know, I did have one of those to power my kids' TV before. They were going to get pretty svelte on it, but yeah.
We're talking to Winona LaDuc. So you are here testifying on behalf of the carbon cap in New Mexico. And I guess the idea is that New Mexico provides leadership so that other states will get inspired to do the same thing.
I'm hoping. That is what I'm hoping.
Yeah.
That New Mexico provides leadership so that other states can do the same thing.
Tell us about your organization, Honor the Earth.
So Honor the Earth works, I work for two organizations, really. So I'm at the offices of the White Earth Land Recovery Project right now, which is like a community-based community development organization that works on local food and local energy economies on the White Earth Reservation. And I say that always because, you know, the work I do nationally at Honor the Earth is predicated and based on strategy that comes from a community. We didn't spin straw into gold and spin ideas out of anywhere, you know, and just all theory. I understand what it is like to work in a rural community on the issues of fuel poverty, where you cannot pay your fuel bill, food security, where you cannot get enough good food to eat, and a third of your people have diabetes, and energy sovereignty. You know, I understand what it is in these ideas. So I do this here, and then I work nationally with Honor the Earth, which is on behalf of whom I'm testifying at the hearing, which I believe is next week.
Right.
And in that, the Environmental Improvement Board. And in that, my experience is that I'm working in these communities that are already heavily afflicted by climate change, or I'm working in communities like we are supporting this work up in northern Alberta to stop the tar sands expansion, which is the dirtiest oil you could have in terms of its impact on the environment. And, you know, you see these communities that are very, very, very impacted disproportionately, environmental justice issues, but issues of technological choice and greed by corporations. And there is something that is incredibly, unjust. And at this point, we have the ability to do the right thing. And so, you know, I'm coming to New Mexico to say what happens in New Mexico matters to the rest of us. I have worked in New Mexico off and on for the past, first time I worked there was 1979, in the bottom of the Anaconda uranium mine at Laguna Pueblo. Testimony, hearings. I'm familiar with the energy economy of the state of New Mexico since 1979. When I was down there at the age of 20. And I see New Mexico as a state that is poised in the place that we are in our prophecies, in this opportunity to make a choice between two worlds. One is well-worn and scorched. That's what the fossil fuel nuclear economy looks like. And one is not well-worn and it's green. And that's what a solar, wind, local food, local energy, efficient economy looks like. And the second over the long term, it's going to be healthy.
Winona LaDuc, thanks so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Yeah, thanks for having me very much. And really the best to you down there, and I hope that you all have a good day.
Thank you, and we'll see you here in New Mexico.
Yep, thank you. Miigwech.
We've been talking to Winona LaDuc. She is a Native American activist, economist, environmentalist, and writer. She's the executive director of the organizations Honor the Earth and White Earth Land Recovery Project. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks so much to Sean Conlon for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.